You've all met Stuart already, but just as a reminder, Stuart's a leading scholar of fantasy literature and an academic here at Oxford, and he'll be speaking to us next on, on J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah. You've heard of him.
Yes, yeah. Right.
So, thank you very much, everyone, and thank you all for coming, and everyone who's online again, just to repeat our thanks to you. This is proving a fantastic event. And so the title of my talk, or the task I've been set, is to talk about J.R.R. Tolkien. And you remember yesterday, or some of you who were here, I proposed a framework of how to look at or discuss a fantasy writer, a fantasy text, and so on. So I'm gonna mark my own homework and try and work through the Discworld framework with J.R.R. Tolkien. And I guess it is appropriate that we're kind of halfway through this summer school, and here's Tolkien, because the conversations often go everything that happened before Tolkien and everything that happens after Tolkien. So he's that pivotal point. And keeping with Terry Pratchett, just because so many people came up to me and said, I'm so glad to hear Terry Pratchett mentioned, I'll give you a quote from Terry Pratchett. J.R.R. Tolkien has become a sort of mountain, appearing in all subsequent fantasy in the way that Mount Fuji appears so often in Japanese prints. Sometimes it's big and up close, sometimes it's a shape on the horizon. Sometimes it's not there at all, which means that the artist either has made a deliberate decision against the mountain, which is interesting in itself, or is in fact standing on Mount Fuji. And whatever you think of Tolkien, good or bad, we cannot escape him, so therefore it is appropriate that we try to go through him as a writer. I'm just going to start with the things that you probably need to know so that we're all on the right at the same level. So the key text that you need to sort of familiarize yourself with, and you probably already have, are The Hobbit, 1937. I'll come back to why 1951 is in brackets. The Lord of the Rings, 1954 to 55. The Silmarillion, published posthumously in 1977, edited by his son. The other two key texts I would say you should get into your library of Tolkien studies in terms of his writing are his Letters, which was revised and came out in 2023, and his Poetry, which came out for the first time last year in 2024 in terms of the full collected edition. But we should also rejoice, perhaps, in the fact that there are many other texts appearing under his name. The History of Middle-earth series, 12 volumes, plus The Nature of Middle-earth, which came out in 1996. I should have put Unfinished Tales in here, sorry. An extraordinary study by his son, Christopher, into the composition of the various texts that we've just referred to outside of The Hobbit. There are the great tales which have appeared, the four great tales which are referenced and came out in their own separate edition. There are the minor tales, Rotherhandum, Farmer Giles of Ham, Smith of Wotton Major, etc., etc. And then there are the other texts, which I will come on to in a second, his academic writing. And there are a lot of secondary reading texts. We are not short of academic studies of Tolkien. And there are a few there, and there are many more. I would just really like to highlight the work done by Wayne Hammond and Christina Scull, which is the top one there, the J.R.R. Tolkien Companion and Guide. I'm not familiar with a text like this for other writers, in that it not only gives you a detailed analysis of all the themes in Tolkien, but in the chronology, more or less a month-by-month account of what he was doing. To absolute precise details. So extraordinary material out there if you wish to carry on. Okay, so the standard he was born in. Here's the life of J.R.R. Tolkien, born in 1892 and dies in 1973. So he lives to a ripe old age, and he's born in South Africa, but he's English through and through. He moves back when he's very young. King Edward School, Birmingham. And then with a couple of minor sort of diversions, he's an Oxford person through and through, studies at Exeter, as we've already heard, classics, then English, and then comes back here to become professor at Pembroke and then Merton. And we have in the dates there of The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings. So there are two things I just want to point out about this. First of all, as you'll see in 1915, Not a good time to be a young person. He enlists in the Lancashire Fusiliers, 1916. He fights on the Battle of the Somme, and many people have talked about the influences of that. But the second thing, and most notably, is his job is as an academic. He was not paid to be a writer of fantasy fiction. He was paid to lecture, teach, and supervise researchers here. And that point will come up again. Okay, so was Tolkien writing fantasy? I gave a talk on Friday to the prospective students at Oxford, and I said, was Tolkien writing fantasy? And I said, yes, he was. Now, that's about it. And none of them got the joke. So they all sat there looking bewildered, but I said, okay, well, let's explore it a bit more. But clearly he was. So let's, if we take what I was saying yesterday about the definition, the impossibility test, The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, The Silmarillion, all pass the impossibility test. It just doesn't happen and couldn't happen. And we could also say the same for some of his minor tales. Some of them do sort of start blurring the boundaries between his work, isolated work, but also his mythology. But they're also definitely texts of a fantasy nature. But I wanted to just pick up a couple of extracts here, which we suddenly got sight of last year. So on the left is the start of a poem called Tol Eressëa, which really is embedded in his mythology. Tol Eressëa is a mystical island where the elves live in his mythology. And you can see he's writing that in early 1916. He reworks that poem only a few months later, and this time he dedicates it for England, the Lonely Isle, in June 1916. So it's a fantasy poem, or a poem about his mythology, it certainly is. But then he repurposes it as he is sent out to the Western Front, and it becomes a memory, a eulogy to what he's leaving behind, notably England and Edith, his wife. So he was writing fantasy. Well, was he? Well, he certainly wasn't paid to write fantasy, as I've already made the point. And this is something which you will occasionally hear in the English faculty, or certainly did, about Tolkien. This is a list of his academic publications. Seem to be missing one there, The Anchor and the Whisser, which is kind of major. I think the key thing you'd say from this, two things. One is his scholarship was very, very good. We still cite a lot and read a lot of his works. The second thing you'd say is there's not a lot there. He did not publish extensively, and one of the criticisms of Tolkien is that he did not publish as many things as he probably should have. However, he appears time and time again, and an anecdote which I've told many times, but I hope this audience will forgive me, is one day I was going up, I was being interviewed at Radio Oxford, and I was in the taxi driver, and the taxi driver said to me, what are you going to be interviewed about? I said, oh, a new book by Tolkien. And he said, he's dead, isn't he? And he's quite right. There's a lot of posthumous material coming out by J.R.R. Tolkien. So these are the types of things you may have seen, The Legend of Sigurd and Gudrun, Fall of Arthur, Beowulf, and so on. And I got to thinking about these things, and I tried to sort of group them. So in the center, if you want to, you can go away and read The Monsters and the Critics, which are a selection of his lectures and essays. They're not all of them. There are a lot of his lectures still sitting in Bodleian, which have been unpublished and not worked on as much as perhaps they should have. And on the left, you could say, well, they're kind of scholarly text translations, which I would add The Anchor and the Whisser from 62 in. But on the right, there's an element of him having a go. And I'll come back to this about gap filling, etc. You could argue this, you could argue which way they fall, but Fall of Arthur, Kullervo, The Lay of Atruan, Itruan, these are all areas where he's trying to have a go. And by gap filling, I mean he's sort of imagining what else might have happened. So the text there about Finn and Hengist, an episode in Beowulf and then in the Finnsburg fragments, and he kind of steps away and he goes, what actually did happen here? And he has a go. He has a go at writing it. So we'll come back to that again and again throughout the talk. You may recall I came up with the subgenres and high epic fantasy. Yes, without a doubt, Tolkien was writing what we loosely call high and epic fantasy. It is a tale, particularly The Lord of the Rings, of good v. evil. It is on a scale that is extraordinary. It's the end of the Third Age, the culmination of the First and Second Age, you could probably say. It starts in northwest Middle Earth and goes down to kind of southeast Middle Earth to a degree. There's a world-threatening crisis. It's an existential threat to Middle Earth. Just ask yourself, what would have happened to everyone if Sauron had actually won? And it's also something which John Clute talks about in his Encyclopedia of Fantasy. It is about thinning. There is this element of transience, of past glories fading. And this comes up again and again, but the quote always reminds me is, "Leaf is Lana, from Old English, life is on loan. But that passed away, so may this," from Deor. That idea that past glory and sometimes past threats can pass away. So there's my D. If you remember, my I was really about the setting, intrusive, liminal, or secondary world. And I think fairly easily we could say this is a secondary world or immersion, as far as Mendelssohn has said. Middle Earth simply didn't happen. It doesn't exist. You can't find any of those places on a map of our known Earth, for certainly. So it is that secondary world that we go into and immerse ourselves. But is it? Now, you can take this picture with a pinch of salt. It's an artist's impression, and it always looks to me like a set of lungs. But basically, what we are seeing here is an attempt to show Arda, Tolkien's Earth or planet. And that's the kind of area there, that's the Middle Earth, where most of the action takes place in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. And then on the left here, we have the Undying Lands. And then in the middle, what Beppe was referring to yesterday, this island, Numenor Island, which links to the Atlantis myth because it disappears beneath the waves. And I think the interesting thing here is that Tolkien repeatedly, again and again, says Middle Earth is our Earth. This is our Earth. But you look at that, and you probably would be forgiven to say, well, it doesn't look anything like a map of the globe I've seen recently. And it clearly doesn't. But throughout his mythology, there are these seismic shifts in the continents which change everything. But most importantly, and this is, I think we'll come onto this later, is that these lands to the west, at the end of one of his myth cycles, disappears. Not just disappears beneath the waves, but seems to go out onto another dimension. And what was originally a flat Earth becomes a rounded Earth. And the only way that you can find your way to these lands, as the elves do continuously in Lord of the Rings, is by taking the straight or the lost road, which is only allowed to certain individuals. And this allows him to start playing in with all kinds of things about these mythical lands to the west. Not the continent of America, but this out in this other sort of fairy dimension. And the time structures he gives up there are really, you will hear about First, Second, Third Age and so on. He is talking about a grand scale here. But again, he talks about when we enter the Fourth Age, it takes us to the present day, to the day, the age of men, as in humans here, and that there will be this final battle at the end. So he plays fast and loose with this. He's not consistent, which you have to remember with Tolkien, he never is consistent. He constantly contradicts himself. But this idea that perhaps this was a prehistory of the world is something which we should bear in mind. And the letter I referenced there was his explanation, and again, we're gloriously fortunate to have it, of his entire mythology, which he wrote to the publisher, Milton Waldman, in 1951. And a text which I think has been mentioned, it was mentioned yesterday, is the Notion Club papers, which was originally The Lost Road, which he writes, 1945, Lost Roads a bit earlier, and it's that response to Lewis, I'll write something about space travel, you write something about time travel. And you can get it in the History of Middle-earth, Sauron Defeated. And basically the plot is there is this club, the Notion Club, Notion Inklings, get it? And someone ferreting around in the Bodleian in 2012 finds this manuscript of their notes, which is notes that they were having meetings in the 80s, remember he's writing this in 1945, of this club that meets and starts to sort of do the things that the Inklings did. But particularly what we start to get is a couple of the protagonists start to dream and have visions and then go on journeys where they start to realize that there's a continuity from their present time and their names going back through Anglo-Saxon times all the way to Numenor, and that's his time travel. So again, an attempt to knit his mythology together with everything that he had studied. Okay, setting. This is my Discworld again. Yes, of course, it's pseudo-medieval. There are Germanic influences, which we've discussed again and again. The trolls, the dwarves, the elves, the dragons. And I find it interesting what he said there. It's desirable if you can, necessary if you can, to use words that are already in existence, which have a certain sense and are laden with a certain sense. And therefore, I use dwarves and Middle-earth and elves and so on. You can't have everything absolutely strange at the outright. And I do think he kind of has something to say there. And I actually, personally, when I read or about to launch into a new series of fantasy writings, it's a bit of a struggle to get through that first chapter where you get all of those strange names and strange places, because he seizes on this. So he's doing it for various reasons, but he guides the idea that, well, look, these are already embedded in people's imagination, so I can reuse them. And I will come back to this piece of text again and again. I've written on this chapter here, so for those of you who've read my article, apologies, but this is from The Lord of the Rings, The Siege of Gondor, Return of the King, Book 5, Chapter 4, and you can see here, this is at the end of the Siege of Minas Tirith, the language, the range that's being used here, a huge ram, knight, shot and dart, siege towers, gate, etc., all the types of things we would associate with a medieval setting. I find myself saying this again and again, don't I? But is it? Is it really? Well, someone's already made the mention of this, I think, in terms of the Shire. The Shire is we can pretty much date it to Victoria's Jubilee. It is that capturing of that Victorian idyll that Tolkien himself experienced as a child. And as many people pointed out, there are some archaic details in there which just do not make sense. They have clocks. So, you know, well, good, well done, the hobbits, you know, and umbrellas. They've already managed that, whereas the rest of the Middle-earth is struggling. They have steam kettles and so on, and they have post offices. So they're kind of not in that pseudo-medieval world, is basically what you're trying to say. And then we move into something, the second red dot, Bree, for example, where we are moving back, a town with inns, etc. You're talking probably 14th century. Take Rohan, although he argued constantly, it is Anglo-Saxon England. So we're probably talking about 10th, 11th century at least. Then you get into Gondor. Well, he talks about Byzantine and Constantinople, etc. But sometime a bit after the, sort of maybe late Middle Ages or sometime around that. And then we have the Pukul men and so on. It just shouldn't work when you think about it because it isn't consistent. So it is right to say you come away from it thinking this is a medieval setting, but actually it's very easy to find areas where it isn't. However, it was described as the last great work of the Middle Ages, The Lord of the Rings, but I would just like to say there's a lot of pushback against this in that Tolkien, I believe, is a very modern writer. There's this traditional view, he just didn't care, he rejected modern life, which is just simply not true. And he reads extensively of modern writers, etc. And we've already touched on the fact that he is engaged very heavily early on in environmental issues, which we then pick up later and later, industrialization and commercialization. And I'd just like to read, if I can, an extract from a poem. And this is Progress of Bimble, or Progress in Bimbletown, which he writes in 1928. And it's really a sort of his view of what's happening to the British seaside. And having spent a summer down in North Devon, I have a lot of sympathy for it. So he describes this place, Bimbletown, it's sort of a seaside resort or somewhere near the sea where people come and people come on holiday and on day trips. Sometimes through it, and this is rare, one can hear the shouts of boys. Sometimes late, when motorbikes are not passing with a screech, one hears faintly, if one likes, the sea still at it on the beach. At what? At churning orange rind, piling up banana skins, gnawing paper, trying to grind a broth of bottles, packets, tins, before a new day comes with more, before next morning sharabangs stopping at the old inn door with reek and rumble, hoots and clangs, bring more folk to God knows where, to they don't mind, to Bimbletown, where the steep street that once was fair with many houses staggers down. It's a real view of sort of like that unrestricted sort of spread of people going out and just throwing their rubbish out at the sea and it's being washed up and the destruction of things. And to me, that almost reads it. If that was in a collection of works by John Betjeman, I wouldn't be surprised. So to say that he isn't concerned with modern ideas, I think, is just wrong. And I think also we've mentioned disenchantment. I think disillusionment is actually the term I use because it was a key concept that emerges after the First World War when people come back and this wasn't a land fit for heroes and they found out all of the things that went wrong in the First World War. And I think he tackles that head on. He tackles exactly what's happening in the period between the wars, but also after the Second World War, when we were told in the 50s, no, all you should be reading are the kitchen sink dramas and the movement. He was saying, no, I think people still harken back to some ideas that were not powerless against some of the horrors that beset us. And we do have a desire to go back to some of our roots. So I do think he's a modern writer in that sense. Okay, characterization. This was D-I-S-C. We've got to disc. And I mentioned the dwarves in The Hobbit, as in they're not very good in terms of character profiles, but let's pass over because it's The Hobbit. And criticising The Hobbit is like kicking a puppy, so let's not do that. But a clear criticism of Tolkien is that, you know, where are the female characters in The Hobbit? Well, there aren't any. Or in The Lord of the Rings. There are, of course, in The Lord of the Rings. And we can argue at length about that, about how well portrayed they are. But you can, it's a sign of desperation when people say, well, there are. Look, there's Shelob. But, you know, and maybe his understanding of Eowyn's sudden conversion to liking Faramir just because she's looking over a wall is perhaps not an exact study in attitudes, let's put it that way. However, this criticism is excessive. And if you look in the Silmarillion, particularly if you look in the original drafts of the Silmarillion and use Arda Reconstructed, a great book which shows you, he builds some very strong female characters, and really, they're very prominent in that book. So I don't think it's as fair, but it's you can understand why people did it just because of the published books. He got criticised a lot, and he still gets criticised. It's just good and evil. Everyone's good, and everyone's bad, and that's it. And the good people win, and the bad people lose. It's nowhere near as simple as that. And I think, as he observed, and I completely agree, people who say that clearly haven't read the book, particularly The Lord of the Rings. If we take, for example, the orcs, in Peter Jackson's films, they are what they are. They are just horrendous sort of cannon fodder. But as he said, we do get insights into the way the orcs think occasionally. And if you think of those sort of chapters where Sam and Frodo Frodo's captured after the sting for Shelob and Sam overhears the orcs talking, or when they are dressed as orcs and they're being marched around Mordor, you hear the orcs. And they're just like soldiers, basically. They're grumbling all the time. They're grumbling about their conditions. They're grumbling about their officers. They don't want to be there half the time. So you do kind of get that. Yeah, there's some less than pleasant characteristics about orcs, like cannibalism and so on, and that they tend to sort of just march through and slaughter. But I do believe if you study them, it is good. And actually, and Rings of Power, let's put that to there. But I do think they're interesting. They're delving into the character of orcs, which is quite good. I mentioned doubling yesterday, and it's, you know, they're Faramir. How Faramir reacts compared to how Boromir reacts. How Aragorn is in terms of what he is trying to achieve as the Lost King, reclaiming his throne, compared with the Nazgul and how they behaved as kings or leaders. Sam and Frodo, and without a shadow of doubt, anyone who criticises Tolkien's characterisation, you just go back and go, well, what about Gollum? where we get that psychological struggle in an individual. And actually, if you put Gollum alongside Sam and Frodo, you get that classic tripartite characterization where all three make the whole. And for those of you, this is an example I often use. It may be a bit churlish, but if you think of McCoy, Spock, and Kirk, the three just complement each other in Star Trek, and that's how it kind of works. I'm not saying they're like that, but they're much better developed than those three. But think of that. So, okay, world building. Of course, Tolkien takes time to develop his mythology. I'll come back to the Voyage of Earendil, the Evening Star, in a bit. But here we have, he's starting to work in 1915, 1916 on the Book of Lost Tales, which is where a mariner finds their way to the Elven homelands, the Elven Isle, and they start to hear tales. So we have that framing structure, which we'll come back to again, and then he's working on it again and again all the way through The Lord of the Rings. And as I said, it posthumously comes out as the book that we now have called The Silmarillion, but there's a lot more to it than that. And the key thing you have to take from this is that if The Lord of the Rings doesn't reach print until 1954, he's been working on his mythology for 40 years. And we have to think about fantasy writers, and we're going to hear from some later, and there are some in the room, I know. Do you spend 20 years building your mythology without any thought to ever getting it published? And then put a tail on the top, because that's exactly what Tolkien did, and Simon was exactly right. He never intended The Hobbit to get published. In fact, he never intended The Hobbit to be set in Middle Earth. It kind of got sucked into it before he knew it. And that's what's interesting about Tolkien. Why is he doing this? Well, he's doing it kind of for fun, but he lays the foundations for reasons we'll come on to, and then he adds overlays the stories. And the foundation was the invention of languages. The stories were made rather to provide a world for the languages than the reverse. To me, a name comes first and the story follows. He was playing around with inventing languages as a child. He loved it. He's a philologist. He carries on, and he develops them, as you all know. But he realizes a language can't just exist without a living world to put them in, and that's what drives him to start writing his mythology. And world building, and I'm going to show a couple of examples here, is extraordinary, I think, in Tolkien. So on the right, you have a standard Proto-Indo-European family tree of languages, and some of us will be familiar with these things. Tolkien certainly was. It tries to show how the roots of language develop. And on the left, we have him playing around exactly that, tree of tongues, where he shows the relationship between the languages and so on. He's thinking at that level, which is absolutely extraordinary. If you don't think it is, let's carry on with that, shall we? So, attention to detail. The ghostly images behind are because copyrighted, of course, but I've taken some quotes where he's working out here the distance to the Fords of Isen, 15 miles, to the Gates of Isengard, 30 miles. How far can a hobbit or orcs move on foot compared with someone on a horseback? So he gets to some struggles. Well, if it's a full moon, which way will the shadows lie that I have to think about? Do I have to change the text as they're going up the steps of Cirith Ungol? And he starts doing that. He gets a cop-out, basically. So he takes, what's the moon cycle in 1944? I'll plonk that on my book, but it works. And I love this quote. At this point, I require to know how much later the moon gets up each night when nearing full, and how to stew a rabbit. And then he starts to work on structures, on January the 16th, the Company Ring, there's the Battle of the Bridge in Moria, Gandalf Falls, Gollum's Dogging and Company. And he has, you can see them if you look at, for example, the Voyage en Terre de Milieu, the collection from the exhibition in Paris, really detailed plans of his plots. It always reminds me a bit of, I gather when they were doing Fawlty Towers, John Cleese and Connie Booth had a massive wall full of plot structures, and they mapped out exactly to the line of the script how it would all come together. So it's a bit like that. Again, attention to detail is extraordinary. Flora, fauna, geography, distances. And sometimes his mythology overtakes him. So the the tale about why The Hobbit in 1951 is important is because if you read the first version of The Hobbit in 1937, when the ring appears with Gollum and the riddles, etc., basically the story goes, Gollum, oh, yeah, look, if you win, I'll give you this ring. And of course, then he writes The Lord of the Rings, and that's the last thing Gollum would do, is just hand over the ring. He doesn't hand over, Bilbo finds it. So then he has to rewrite The Hobbit in the light of how the mythology is changing, and he does that, and the revised version comes out in 1951. And that then puts him in a quandary, because you could go into a bookshop, and if you get the 1937 edition down, you're going to get a very different tale from the 1951 edition down. And Tolkien doesn't just leave it at that. Of course, he says, well, basically, the 1937 version is the one Bilbo tells the dwarves, but the 1951 version is the one we all know to be the truth that he reveals later in Frodo and Sam pick up. Attention to detail, it is extraordinary. Okay, so objective, why is he doing this? We've talked again and again about on fairy stories. And, you know, a bit like that letter from 1951, we are so fortunate that just at the point he's really engaging with the Lord of the Rings and his mind is shifting, he delivers this lecture, which then is published, which really is his treatise, his theories about fantasy literature. I would say don't just read that, go off and read Mythopoeia, his poem, which is a result of a walk with Lewis and Dyson in Magdalen College, and also the essay that came out in the 2005 edition of Smith and Wootton Major, that you have to kind of read them in the round. But On Fairy Stories is so important. It was delivered in 1939 as a lecture and then published in 1947. And I think these points have already made. He's really setting out that fantasy or fairy stories are not just for children. Let's rescue them from the nursery, because they really take on, or sorry, portray or convey the human, key human faculty, and that is about sub-creation, making secondary worlds. This is something which we aspire to do. And if you do this successfully, you will engender secondary belief in the reader. They will immerse themselves fully in the text. They will believe what they are reading and they'll come out of it. And he talks a lot. He has some really interesting points here, which again have come up, I think, yesterday, about recovery. Because you're in this fantasy world, you then get a clear view of things we take for granted. You can see reality freshly. But it also allows you to escape, and escapism is a term that has thrown at fantasy incorrectly, I think. I don't think it is. But what he's saying here, it's escape because we can escape the confines of reality, of mimetic literature, if you want, and like a prisoner escaping jail. And then there is consolation, which we'll come on to in a second. Okay, I'm just going to put this here because it's a theory which, well, I first came across it by the great scholar of Tolkien studies, Tom Shippey, and that is the asterisk reality, which is another thing that Tolkien's done, and I've hinted at it already. On the right, if you don't know, what you're looking here is, again, a philologist's playground, where we're looking at the words 11 and elf, both means 11, of course, and they go back and they go back, and then they get back to a point and they go, yeah, we don't quite know what the word would have been in Proto-Germanic, but we'll come up with an idea. And that's probably what it looks like. And you'll see there's an asterisk there. So it's filling in the gap where we don't have it. And this is what starts Tolkien off. I said I'd mention this poem from 1914. The top, you'll see the manuscript, the Old English of the Old English poem, Christ One by Cynewulf, the imaginatively titled Christ One. Christ Two is better. And there is a Christ II, Christ III fades. But on there, you know, as we've read this and everyone's done it, Hail Eärendil, brightest of angels sent to men over Middle Earth, a true radiance of the sun. And something sparks in his mind and he reads that and he goes, well, who is this Eärendil? What is it? We don't quite know. We think it's possibly Venus or something like that. So, being Tolkien, even in 1914, he trots off and he writes The Voyage of Eärendil, The Evening Star. And when he was asked by one of his friends, what's it about? He says, I don't know. I'll try to find out. And that actually, if you look at his composition of The Lord of the Rings, often things flow in and he goes, where did that come from? And then he tries to work it out. So it's a kind of example of asterisks where we've got what survives, but where did it come from? In his case there, Earendil becomes the mariner in his tales. And you'll see this again and again in his Beowulf edition. We get the Selic spell. Beowulf is probably a bringing together of multiple tales, probably by a single author, but things were happening centuries before that they've picked up. So he doesn't just take that for granted. He goes out and tries to write one of the tales that maybe the poet behind Beowulf picked up. The Homecoming of Beornith, Beorhtrum's son. Battle of Maldon, a famous poem in Old English, but battle in 991. Well, what happened after the battle? I know, I'll go and write a verse drama about it and just try and work out what it happens there. But in terms of his mythology, we have all of the things, the dwarves, elves, trolls. So what he's doing there is, look, if you read Old English, you read Middle English, as we've heard again and again, you come across these creatures. But why? Where did they come from? Where did the ideas come from? I know, I'll write a prehistory where there are dwarves, elves, and trolls, etc., and there's a Middle Earth. And I'll write one about Ents, Enter Yweyork, as we've already heard from the ruin, but also possibly linked to Macbeth, where he was a bit fed up that the trees really didn't go up Dunsinane Hill. And then there's the Lost Road, the Notion Club papers, this idea that there's a mythical land to the west. Well, King Sheev in Beowulf, there's this character at the beginning who is sent off, comes from somewhere and goes off somewhere. Well, that's what he's playing with in that, or the Voyages of St. Brendan, those Peregrinus Pro Amore Dei, who sailed off madly into the Atlantic Ocean from Ireland. But in the Tale of St. Brendan, he finds a mystical isle. And even when you get to the Hobbit rhymes, you know, he starts writing his Man in the Moon tales, poems early on. But, you know, they then become those nursery rhymes that we tell you, Hey Diddle, the Cap and the Fiddle. Well, he writes the earlier poem that then led to the one we tell. And of course, then he thinks, that's a Hobbit rhyme. And it becomes in the Tales of Tom Bombadil and so on. So it's all about gap filling. Objective, I'll just go on about a few things which have already come up. He does say this is all about fall, mortality, and the machine. Fall, there's a lot of people who fall in Tolkien's mythology, Morgoth, Sauron, Feanor, Thorin. They all fall from grace in some way or other. And the book, as you know, is the downfall of the Lord of the Rings. Mortality is another key area which he plays a lot with. The problem of death, the escaping of death, and he even said that this idea of the escape from death or death is the key spring of... Now, everyone thinks he says the Lord of the Rings. I dispute that. I think he says the Law of the Ring. But anyway, he says that's what the books are all about, death and trying to evade it. And this is all obviously a very Catholic view, has already been mentioned. He was a devout Catholic and very active in the Catholic Church, and particularly in Oxford, what was happening here. And then the third area is the machine, that technology can corrupt nature or destroy nature or corrupt people. And I think all of these, again, are very modern views. There are things which we probably come up again and again with. My R was roots. Where does he fit in the long history? And this is actually a slide which has worked well, because what it does is pick up everything you've heard so far. So do you remember yesterday we talked about that hoovering up of myths and legends, possibly for nationalist purposes, by people to collect them together and then put them out? Well, one of the things he was slightly upset about was he didn't think England had its own mythology. So he plays again inconsistently with this, but he is perhaps toying with this idea that he could create a cycle of myths for England, to my country. We also heard about fairy tales, folklore tales, but fairy tales. And one, I don't think he's been mentioned yet, but a bit strong influence on Tolkien as a child was the Andrew Lang coloured fairy tale books, which aren't just about fairy stories and fairy tales. There's a lot of some old Norse legends and repurposing in there. What we heard last night, and we've heard a bit this morning, you know, he read Morris, Dunsany, Haggard, particularly the She novels as well. They all influence him. David Lindsay, I think, has been mentioned, a strong influence. Grace has just talked about E.R. Edison. So all of these things are in this cauldron, and everything you've heard about, in a way, leads to this talk. One thing which he said, I fear you may be right, that the search for the source of the Lord of the Rings is going to occupy academics for a generation or two. and I hold my hands up, I'm one of them, and a book that myself and a colleague did, Elizabeth Solopova, where we take the Silmarillion, the Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, and go on. And what we're trying to do there is going, look, there's an episode in these books. It really links or has a lot of similarities what you'll find in these Old and Middle English and Old Norse and Finnish texts. Okay, my L, I'm nearly there in terms of my Discworld. Magic in Middle Earth, just because we had it as part of Adam's definition. He says he was a bit casual with the word magic and he didn't really use it correctly. Actually, when you look at it, he's quite sparing in his use of the term magic in The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, and so on, and sorcery, and so forth. And again, as Tolkien, he thinks very deeply about it. Magic has to be believable to keep up the secondary belief, but he understates it, I think. I think you get natural magic in there, you'll get the monsters, the creatures, which are magical, but it is not the full-on J.K. Rowling school of magic. It is very underplayed. And of course, Tolkien, being the academic, then starts to think about magic and starts to think about its roots and some of the terminology and the philology that goes with it. And he starts to define, going back on some medieval and classical theories about magia and goetia, the physical magic or the spells and the conjuring. And he elaborates on this, so you can go away and read this letter. But magic could be, as was, held good, and goetia bad. Neither is in this tale good or bad, but only by motive or purpose or use. Both sides use both, but with different motives. And what I think it's important here to say is that it isn't the magic that's important, it's what you do with it. And that's what Tolkien is trying to convey in this tale of power struggle. Depth. I think depth, I've realised, is really world-building, but let's just go with it. Depth allows him to achieve his goal of getting the inner consistency of reality so that you as a reader believe in what you're doing. And there's various things he does here. So scholarly apparatus, so your maps at the book, there's introductory essays, there's appendices, there's the annals, and so on and so forth. A lovely example, I think, oops, sorry about the text that's just appeared on there, is the left is the Book of Mazabul, which he actually sits there and makes that, thinking it will go in the illustrated version of Lord of the Rings, but it didn't. And he uses his knowledge of what happens in medieval manuscripts like Beowulf on the right. So there are maps, so the map at The Hobbit at the beginning bases ourselves in it, and then we get the Lord of the Rings. References to the past, another classic. I don't know if he was the first, but he does it probably the best. Subsequent writers try to do this, such as G.R.R. Martin, not as well. But examples here from The Hobbit. Before you could get round to the south, you would get into the lands of the necromancer, and even you, Bilbo, won't need me to tell you the tales of that black sorcerer. And of course, he never does, and we never find out in The Hobbit. But we know that there's something going on. And then Fellowship of the Ring, I do not think that tale should be told now, with the servants ending in their hand. And this is all an example of depth, because what happens is you get a glimpse that there is something much bigger going on behind this story. And of course there is, because he's worked on it for 20 and 30 years. And then he uses the framing devices, which has been mentioned. So the Book of Lost Tales I already talked about. But The Hobbit is, of course, The Hobbit, or There and Back Again, being the record of a year's journey made by Bilbo Baggins, compiled from his memoirs by J.R.R. Tolkien and published by George Allen and Unwin. And Lord of the Rings survives to us by through the Red Book of Westmarch. And there's a potted history of that manuscript and how it survives from the Shire all the way to us. I mean, on the ruins of The Hobbit, it's all nonsense, of course. But it's brilliant in a way, because it does give you that. You read it and you go, really? Really? Oh, is that how it happened? Oh yeah, the Book of Westmarch, it must be sitting in Bodleian or something like that. And Tolkien found it and he's translated it, not very well, that explains some of the inaccuracies in Lord of the Rings. But then you go, no, of course, none of this happens. But it's a framing device, it's a way of doing depth. Okay, so that was my proposed framework. 1 minute to go. Okay, style. The thing which I felt it's missing, and I won't do this very quickly, is style. So perhaps we should call it Discworlds. And that piece of text from the end of Minas Tirith, the siege of Minas Tirith, I think is important. And as I said, I've written on this quite extensively, but you can see so much going on in here, even if you just take it. Forget the rest of the Lord of the Rings, just read this extract. We get magic, we get that in there. Words of power and terror to rend heart and stone, as if stricken by some blasting spell, and we get magical creatures, so it is fantasy. We get characterization in there, we get Gandalf. Gandalf and Shadowfax, I think is, we forget Shadowfax, bless him, but he's in there. And the words that Tolkien uses with Gandalf and Shadowfax about unmoving, they're commanding, they're stoic, they're still. We get the Witch King, this is where the Witch King rides into Minas Tirith, and he uses an example of what we call variation in medieval literature. Look at the multiple descriptions of the Witch King, a horseman, the black captain, the huge shadow, the black rider, etc. He completely does that to layer on the effects of who this thing is. And also that this is a person who moves, who commands power, whereas Gandalf and Shadowfax just stand still. The Witch King keeps moving forward and nearer and nearer. We get characterization. If you forget Shadowfax, don't forget Gron, the battering ram. Gron, the battering ram, actually takes on a life of its own. It isn't just they shove a ram at the door. We get the name of Gron, we get its background, and Gron crawls on. He isn't pushed on. Gron starts to become a living creature. And then we get in what Tolkien often gets criticized as about his style. It is full of this piece, archaic style. The syntax is wrong. We get the verb at the end of clauses, in sort of the way you would in German. And it reads old-fashioned, and the semantics, sorry, are not showing up there. It's full of a register associated with the epic. But he's a genius. It's just repetition. Look at the repetition. The drums rolled louder, the drums rolled and rattled. Thrice he cried, thrice. There's so much going on in this text. There's even alliteration, if you want to look for it. And he controls the pace. If that wasn't enough, 1 minute. He controls the pace fantastically. This is a masterpiece of prose narrative, because you get to that point where that green blob is and you pause and you think it's all over, but he's taking you through it by managing these short sentences and so on. There are even influences from the First World War, I would argue, in that. There are even influences from Christianity. Thrice he cried, a cock crowing at the end, probably about dawn breaking, but we all know the link there to St. Matthew's Bible. And then finally, eucatastrophe. Every time I read this, every time you may have read this, it wasn't one of his favourite scenes, that bit at the end, when the Rohirrim and when the cavalry actually come, brings a lump to your throat. And it was why it made me look back on this scene and just work out why he's doing so well. So, my time is up. I'm just going to say that not everyone likes Tolkien. He got a bit of a kicking when it came out and afterwards, and particularly around the time the polls came out in 2000, and The Lord of the Rings kept getting voted the best book of the 20th century, which really annoyed a lot of people. So that's another reason to applaud Tolkien, particularly the people he annoyed. And there's that extract. And I would just finish his own reflection on it. The Lord of the Rings is one of those things. And if you like it, you do. If you don't, you boo. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this. It was a really rich and fascinating talk. Just a question about, you talked about self-creation very briefly, and we've had it mentioned several times in the past couple of days, and it's just, especially as you sort of touched on eucatastrophe there at the end, and the relationship between these things.
Yeah.
It strikes me that there's kind of two forms of self-creation that we have running. One, in our conversation, one is sort of creation is something underneath, and then one is sort of, I think this is what some of what you're saying is getting at, that from Tolkien and from his Catholic perspective, there's a sense of storytelling is participation, not just something that's sort of like, here is this world that has been created and therefore we then create lesser things, but rather that what we create is building on and continuing a work which has already begun. I wonder if you could talk.
Yes, exactly. So I think you're absolutely right. And the key thing is why it's called sub-creation, because creation, creator, is God. But it's one of the gifts of God, if you like, to humans, is that we have this ability to sub-create. So we're participating. By doing that, and that desire to do that, we're participating in God's work. And we can also, through it, engender, this is Tolkien's theory, you know, what God was trying to tell us, and that's that eucatastrophe, that, you know, there will be a joyous turn, that good will win out in the end. Now, I don't mean that. That doesn't mean that you all have to go away and start writing mythical worlds, because you can be a sub-creator in your own mind, in my view, just by immersing yourself in someone else's world and imagining it. And that's where it moves into imagination, the fact that we can all think, we can all envisage. So we're sub-creators in that sense as well. And I think that's where he was pushing it.
This might be a bit of a silly question, but a lot of the Tolkien having a go, I suppose you could consider Tolkien writing fan fiction. And so how much would you say that working up that level of fan fiction sort of improved his craft in writing? Do you think it had a big influence in what actually he created thereafter?
I think that's not a silly question at all. That's a brilliant point. To think of Tolkien as the precursor of fan fiction, but he was a fan of medieval literature, so he's having a go. Yeah, I think it does develop his style. And so, you know, a lot of the verse you get in Lord of the Rings, he's imitating styles that he picks up from medieval literature. And one of the appendices in the collected poetry volumes. He lists all of the poetic styles, the meters, etc. he wants to have a go at, and all of the poets he really likes, and words that he really liked, and he tries to weave them in, which we do find in his poetry. So I think, yes, it did. No doubt it did. Of course, he's playing around with all kinds of things, prose and poetry. So yeah, that's a great point. Well done.
Our first question is from Ali Mirzabayadi. Thank you, Dr. Lee. Regarding Tolkien's naming, especially since he even composed Old English versions of his texts, do you think his use of Old English and Old Norse was mainly to make his world feel less strange, or was it a part of a more ambitious attempt to build a tower with old stones and fit his literary oeuvre into the tradition of the old northern legends?
So I think the analogy in the second, the point that's been made in the second is a reference to his essay on Beowulf, The Monsters and the Critics, where he uses the image of the tower, and, you know, the tower is the kind of the work, but all we've done is pull it all down and look at the stones, and we've forgotten the scale that you could of the tower itself and what you could see if you stand at the top of it. So I think there's a few things which probably to answer this. First of all, he's drawing on what he knows about. He's drawing on what he enjoys. So he is very adept at doing the names, the nomenclature from Old English, Old Norse, etc. That's possibly what inspires him in the Germanic tales. But of course, I already mentioned Finnish. We have Welsh influences on it, etc. So he draws on a lot of things. But he also has that point he made there that, you know, by using some of these terms and words, they're not too distant from the audience he was originally intending this for, which was a UK audience. Let's start with that. I mean, it obviously has a global impact now. But when you come across those names, particularly if you start with the Shire names, well, they're all around this in Berkshire and Oxfordshire. But then you start to come across, say, some of those names in Rohirrim, you know, the names of the characters there. And they kind of ring true to sort of British people, because when we were at school, we all did 1066 and all that comic book and so on. And we have those names at the back of our head, the Egg Kings and so on. So it begins to pick up, and it begins to feel a bit more familiar. So I think it's multiple angles to that.
I was just wondering whether you think that The Lord of the Rings is literature in the same way that Ulysses or In Search of Lost Time is literature, or whether we have to kind of almost create a new sort of category for what Tolkien is trying to do.
It's a good point. It landed at the wrong time. as I've already mentioned, the mid-50s is not the time when you what people were expecting. And I've written on the radio dramatisation, which came out a year later, and the listeners went, what the hell's this? So, where's the allegory? And Tom Shippey, I think, says it succinctly catches it. He says the reason people don't like Lord of the Rings is because they don't understand it. They don't know what to make of it. So, it bucks the trend. I mean, I think it's literature in the sense that a text that emotionally moves me or would have done in the 50s, I think it will still do that in 100, 200 years. I think people will still be reading it. And it's important because it says a lot about the 20th century. So I think in that sense, yes, it definitely is. But you're right. I mean, it wasn't, as we've seen through all the talks yesterday, unique. But it was, Brian Atterbury kills it, the end of apology. And I think that's absolutely right. By its appearing, we no longer had to apologise as adults for enjoying fantasy literature. And it sort of led to that. So I don't know if that quite answers your question. The succinct answer is yes, it is literature. And yes, it wasn't what people were expecting.
Hiya. Thank you for the talk. I'd be interested in your perspective, having talked about kind of the asterisk theory and touching on earlier the comment on fan fiction, as to how much you think Tolkien and his contemporaries are the reason that fantasy, sci-fi, is now seen as kind of answering the what-if questions, and is that from how they kind of filled in the blanks and the what-if around the talking animals of Narnia, for example? How much of that came before, and how much of it is because of Tolkien and Lewis?
That's a good question, because you're right, particularly in Tolkien, he is playing around with the what-if. What if there had been a world like this, like we're all familiar with in The Lord of the Rings? That would explain all the things that, you know, that then subsequently happen and that we pick up, and Tom Bombadil and the Green Man and so on, you know, and it, you know, it answers it. So in that sense, it is the what if. I suppose it's a bit like the answer there, because it allowed then people to move into that space and start to do that. Now, of course, in science fiction, they've been speculating in all kinds of ways, in particularly in between the war periods, about dystopian, utopian worlds that you could go and find, and that was a way of exploring what we have in here. But they certainly unleashed it, I would think, in terms of a popular genre. But people have always been imagining what if. So I don't want to put Tolkien as the key one. You know, you go back and even to sort of like Thomas More, Utopia, you know, what if. Imagining things like that. So it's been going on for some time, and I suppose even the Epic of Gilgamesh is a what if, isn't it? What if we can try and find out how to have eternal life, which is the first one ever. Thank you.